It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The year is 1992. Bill Clinton is elected president. Tennis great Arthur Ashe is Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, using his platform to advocate for HIV/AIDS awareness. And Madonna's Erotica music video premieres on MTV. We dig into the political and social context in which Erotica was released and how it informs cultural debates today. And you can be part of this conversation. Call in with the question. Share your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Dango is an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. His new book is called Madonna's Erotica. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. So Madonna's body of work, it is extensive. Why did you dive into the album Erotica? Why examine this one?
It sure is extensive, especially as Madonna's about to, or just launched her greatest hits tour throughout the world. I've always been drawn to Erotica, even though it's kind of an underappreciated album of hers. It's her fifth album, you know, not as popular as like a Virgin or something like that. But I think that it really encapsulates for me a lot of the interesting things going on in the 90s, a lot of important cultural debates, cultural wars over conservatism, over the presence of gay artists in public life. So it's just a really interesting touchstone for thinking about a number of issues.
Do you have nostalgia for Madonna's music? What do you think of it?
I do have some nostalgia for her music. I think one of the reasons I'm actually drawn to Erotica is that I identify with it as a sort of transitional moment in her career, in the same way that I've sometimes felt like a member of a transitional generation in the gay community. I'm too young to have really been a peer of Madonna in the 80s and 90s. I'm also too old to have grown up taking for granted some of the civil rights that have been achieved in the past decade, like gay marriage. And I felt that like Madonna similarly is between kind of generations at times in her music. And in Erotica in particular, she's really interested in hearkening back to some of the oldies. She kind of embodies this Marlene Dietrich character. She does a cover of Fever. Her kind of play with time periods is something that I'm interested in too. She seems nostalgic for the past in the way that I might be nostalgic for some of her music in the 90s.
As you talk about time periods, you know, you really caused me pause when you said that we should be skeptical about progress narratives, that society has made progress in areas like equality and you know, human rights, that things are better today than they were 30 years ago. How should we take care in using those comparisons as we sweep across decades?
Yeah, I think for me, there's a real uncanny similarity between some of the political and cultural debates we're having today and the ones that were circling in the early 90s, including some of the renewed anxiety around teaching gay and lesbian issues in university classrooms, to questions about race and police brutality. There's a real similarity, I think, between 1992, when Erotica came out, and 2023, where we are today. And for me, what that tells us is that, you know, we shouldn't always think that things get better over time, that there's always this progress, as you say, in terms of civil rights, that sometimes there's a bit of a more circular pattern to history. And when we find ourselves in a situation that reminds us of the past, then we should be looking to the past for lessons for the present as well, in terms of how to navigate these debates that we're having today.
We're talking about Madonna's album Erotica with Michael Dango, who is author and assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. You can join in the conversation. Call in with the question. Share your perspectives at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, how did you start to realize some of the faults within Madonna's work? Because you definitely lay them out in your book. how did you come to see those?
Yeah, I think, you know, I identify as a fan of Madonna, but a lot of fans of Madonna have not been super happy with some of the things that I say in the book. I think for me, what's important when we look at some of our cultural idols is to not have this kind of black and white view where they're either going to be perfect and get everything right, or they're terrible and need to be canceled. We should think about the kind of complexity of the people that we look up to and have influenced us. And for me, Madonna does a lot of things right and has been really important for boosting the visibility of the queer community and queer issues, including in the early 90s, HIV/AIDS and the stigma associated with that. At the same time, she, you know, doesn't get everything right. And I think that it's not just cynical to say that she's often interested in making money. And so sometimes she courts scandal, and sometimes that's related to advocating for political issues, is that it brings her more publicity as well. And so there's kind of both sides going on here. And I think that we need to be able to sit with that and appreciate what she does well, and maybe what things we can also critique about her.
I was trying to sit with how you call her both archaic and avant-garde. You also call her Madonnasaurus, a fossil. And I mean, in terms of her fashions and then the political movements at the time, like, how does she walk the line? Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened, for instance, in the tour of Erotica, when she went to perform the album in a concert series she called the Girly Show, is that she has this moment kind of partway through where she raises her fist in the sign of Black power. Mm. But then the monologue she proceeds to give isn't about kind of racial inequality at all, but ends up being about the gay community and HIV/AIDS. And I think that's an interesting moment because it was important, certainly, to call more attention to the epidemic and the ways that the government was neglecting care for people who had HIV/AIDS. But it's a complicated moment because she's also appropriating this image from a different social movement around racial inequality. And so I think that's one of those moments where it's hard to kind of judge what she's doing there, where there's something that we might really value, but there's also something that we might be a little critical or suspicious of.
And at this time, Madonna is releasing Erotica. At the same time, her pornographic coffee table book called Sex is published. Do these two, you know, things, album and book, do they share any connections in their messages? Were they a package statement?
That is often how these works were presented to the public, and it's how they were talked about at the time. So in addition to the coffee table book, which is just called Sex and is, as you said, pornographic and has nudity of her and also her boyfriends and lots of other people at the time, she also stars in an erotic thriller called Body of Evidence with Willem Dafoe and Julianne Moore, kind of trying to, you know, ride the wave of Basic Instinct and works like that. So this was definitely presented as like a trilogy of sexiness in the late 90s or late 92 and early 93. But in my book, what I'm actually interested in is how the album Erotica and the book Sex are actually quite different. And Madonna came to actually regret that she released them at the same time, because Sex, the book, shaded how people read or listened to Erotica. And for me, Erotica as an album is actually much more sentimental than it is pornographic. It actually has moments that I think are decidedly unsexy. And I think that that was actually an intention on her part in appealing to a couple different audiences, including her core audience of gay people who were struggling in the midst of the sexually transmitted disease of HIV/AIDS to have a more ambivalent relationship to sex and sexuality. So she's trying to pursue something in Erotica that kind of sounds sexy and pornographic, but at the end of the day, kind of is more like holding hands and just trying to find connection at a real time of devastation and mourning.
Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College, examining the 1990s culture wars, appropriation, the through lines to today. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We turn back the clock to unpack Madonna's 1992 album Erotica, revisiting an earlier moment in queer culture and politics and how it can inform our cultural debates now. Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, you write about how the AIDS epidemic affected Madonna's personal life. Can you take us there? What was happening?
Absolutely. Madonna had a lot of really important relationships in the gay community in the 80s and early 90s. Her high school dance teacher, who is really the one who introduced her to a lot of kind of the show biz and developed her passion for entertaining Christopher Flynn, had died by the time Erotica came out, as well as her roommate in New York. And both of those figures are mourned in Erotica. There are lyrics that are devoted to them in her songs. So HIV/AIDS was really personal for her because of the friends that she was losing, the mentors that she was losing, in addition to just being aware of how it was devastating a larger community, the LGBTQ community, that was a real part of her audience at the time and into the present.
And you cite an essay by Black feminist writer Audre Lorde that draws a difference between feeling and sensation. And you reference the essay when writing about one of the last songs on the album. And let's listen to part of the song In This Life. So you write how this is an invitation to community, particularly in dealing with grief. How is it a calling to be part of the album's message?
I think that what's so interesting about those lyrics we just listened to is that they come in the form of a question addressed to somebody listening to this album. Have you ever watched your best friend die? Have you ever watched a grown man cry? And so she's inviting us into this kind of support group, as you said, where we might be able to hold some of our grief together. She's processing her own grief, but understanding that in addition to a loss of an individual, there's a loss to a community that those individuals are a part of, especially the LGBT community. And that's one of the reasons why this album is so different, as we were talking about earlier, from something more pornographic, like her coffee table book, Sex, because it's processing some of the traumas that are attached to gay and lesbian identity. And that's something that especially comes through in this song.
The queer communities from which she draws inspiration, she holds space, as you mentioned, in the music for the AIDS epidemic. At the same time, though, she's also using the imagery and perhaps appropriating. What is going on there?
Yeah, it's really complicated. The kind of question of, is she giving back to the community as much as she's taking from it? And Erotica is interesting for that as an album because it's her first album since the release of her single Vogue, which probably remains one of her most popular songs. And Vogue is named after a genre of dance that was developed by especially Black and Latino performers in the Harlem underground ball scene in New York, a scene that, you know, she would not have been participating in because of her racial and class position. And so there's a lot of questions about what it means to take that name and that kind of dance and start to perform it you know, at the MTV Music Video Awards, for instance, as she does. And when she does, she performs it, you know, not as an homage to Harlem, but in this kind of French classical costume that she borrows from Dangerous Liaisons that was released at the same time. And so that's a moment where it seems like she's taking something without really drawing attention back to the community that produced it. And I think that there are lots of moments like that in Madonna's career and in anybody's career where some of your influences, some of the things that inspired you end up becoming your own and something that you're not sharing with the community that it comes from. So there's both going on here. And I'm not trying to claim that, you know, she's just a terrible appropriator or that she is this wonderful saint that gets everything right. She's a complicated figure in relationship to the queer community.
Let's listen to a bit of Vogue. Michael, bring us to now. How does Vogue exist within today's drag ball culture?
Absolutely. I mean, we've had a real explosion of increasingly mainstream attention to voguing and to the ball culture and to drag. Ryan Murphy's show Pose on FX was about this scene. And of course, voguing continues to be, you know, constantly referenced and adapted in things like RuPaul's Drag Race. So that remains such an important part of queer culture. And a lot of people's introduction to it, I think, is through Madonna's Vogue. And I mean, for the record, Vogue is probably one of my favorite songs of Madonna. So I think it's a great song. But folks who might not know some of the history behind it might think it's something that Madonna created, for instance, as opposed to the original performers in Harlem. So I'm glad that there's more representations these days that I think tell some of that longer history and allow us perhaps to connect a present scene of queer life to a past scene as well.
Michael Dango with us, author, assistant professor at Beloit College, as we look at Madonna's Erotica album and a new book. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So Erotica is Madonna's first album on her own label. How can you hear a shift in her music?
I think what's so interesting is how she is thinking about a kind of market strategy at the same time. So, you know, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, Erotica's released at the same time as this movie and this book. And so she's, you know, kind of trying to do packaged marketing. At the same time, it's within some of the lyrics too, as I think you're alluding to, that she's really beginning to embrace her identity as a businesswoman, not just a performer. Just a year before Erotica comes out, she's on the cover of Forbes magazine with the headline, you know, America's smartest businesswomen, question mark. And I think the answer to that question was, yeah, probably. She's has this multi-million dollar deal at this time. And so she uses a lot of references actually to sex work in her lyrics in Erotica to think about how her job as a businesswoman is itself a kind of hustling, a kind of trying to sell things, trying to get clients, trying to get satisfy people's desires. That's something that becomes increasingly a presence in this album, is this anxiety around money and how to make it.
Examining Madonna circa 1992, themes that resonate now, Michael Dango's new book, it's called Madonna's Erotica, researches feminist and queer theory as an assistant professor at Beloit College. Join the discussion, call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore political and social touchstones of Madonna's Erotica album from 1992, its legacy in today's cultural debates. The album came out at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. And you can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. As we examine her hustle ability, if you will, and not only to be an entertainer, but to be this, build a business empire, what role do Madonna's movies like Body of Evidence play in the overall reception of this particular album, Erotica?
It's interesting because in Body of Evidence, she plays this kind of femme fatale character who is accused of killing a millionaire that she was sleeping with to get his money. And so there's a kind of performance of sex work there and of being somebody who's going to sell sex just for herself. And this is something that people were always talking about in relationship to Madonna, because she was, compared to many of her peers, so sexual in her performances and in her lyrics, that she was somebody who was selling sex, that she was hustling in that way, too. One of the kind of earliest covers of her in Rolling Stone remarked that she seems to only turn on the sex act when the meter is running. So this kind of sense that it's not genuine, that she's just doing this to make a buck.
And you find Erotica one of her least sexy albums. And so, and that you write about, you know, people's simultaneous fear of sex during the AIDS epidemic and their desire for closeness. How does Madonna convey that concept through this album and through her music?
Yeah, I think in a couple ways. One of the ways is just in the sound of the album. There's a lot of really kind of atmospheric sounds, like kind of being immersed. It almost feels like being in a womb at times, being held by the music, something really comforting, as opposed to something that might be, for instance, arousing, something that's a little bit more like being hugged, as opposed to something explicitly sexual. Some of it also comes through in the lyrics. We listened a little bit ago to the lyrics mourning some of the people she had lost from AIDS. And so a tone that's much more of an elegy, as opposed to, again, a kind of come on. And another thing that she does in this album, actually, when she does end up talking about sex, which again is not actually very common in the album, but when she does, it's often with a bit of a sense of humor. So for instance, in one of her songs, Where Life Begins, which is referring to her genitalia, she has a lyric that goes, Colonel Sanders said it best, finger licking good, referencing KFC at the same time that she's talking about a sexual act. Hmm. And for me, you know, I don't think it's super sexy to think about fried chicken right when we're about to have sex. And I think that she's similarly trying to use humor to kind of defuse some of the tensions we might have around sex and sexuality at this time.
Let's listen to another song. This is Deeper and Deeper, and let's listen to part of the song. So you describe Deeper and Deeper as an example of cultural appropriation. Can you explain why?
I think Deeper and Deeper is appropriating a bit by way of Vogue, which is referenced in the lyrics, Let Your Body Move to the Music. She's also sampling a number of things in this song. The kind of style of the song is a bit all over the place. There's a flamenco bridge partway through because she had just been kind of in the Caribbean where some of that music was playing by way of Spain. There's just a lot of musical styles coming to bear on this song. It's also one of the reasons why the song, I think, is probably a bit too long for what it's supposed to be. It's like almost 6 minutes long because it's just so hungry, I think, for taking in so many kinds of musical samples.
I noticed that too, going back to the song. I was like, I don't remember it being this long. How a song today wouldn't be this long.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, is there a distinction, though, between cultural appropriation in more physical material means such as instrumentation and sampling and immaterial things like language and the words in the song and ideas?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that maybe sometimes some of the sentiments of a song are coming from a community as much as the style of it. I think we can also, you know, distinguish a bit between moments in this album that are like outright thefts and moments where it seems like Madonna is trying to participate in a larger community. So in the title track, Erotica, for instance, she actually just takes a sample of an Easter chant from a really famous Arab singer named Firouz. Without, you know, any kind of consultation or anything. And to this day, Erotica is actually banned in Lebanon because people were so wow. upset that they would steal from the singer that was so popular in Lebanon. So there are like these kind of moments of theft, which seem very clearly to be kind of moments of cultural appropriation. Whereas even in something like Deeper and Deeper, although it's weirdly eclectic in its music, the kind of ways that it's still speaking to some of the needs of the gay community at this time, again, that kind of sense of needing some human connection, even as there might be an anxiety around sex and sexuality itself, that's a kind of contribution that she's making. And so both things are going on here.
You also call James Brown the patron saint of the album the whole way through. What is the connection to his music and what Madonna creates here?
Yeah, I mean, James Brown is probably who sampled the most in Erotica. There's a sample of his 1969 funky drummer. There's a lot of the kind of woo and yeah from Lynn Collins' song Think About It, which was produced by James Brown. He kind of is contributing this sense of funk at times to the music, sometimes directly because of samples from his music, and sometimes indirectly in samples of music he produced, since he was such a kind of prolific played so many roles in the entertainment industry. And I think that those kinds of debts are less acknowledged or explicit in Madonna's music. She doesn't call attention to them in the same ways that she might call attention to things that she's borrowing more directly from a queer community that she was performing in or on the same dance floors with. You know, she wouldn't have had that same subcultural belonging to the same spaces that James Brown was in. So he's definitely a great influence there, and she clearly is indebted to him, but maybe isn't acknowledging that debt as much as she does her others.
Michael Danko, author of the new book called Madonna's Erotica, as we explore the album, look at through lines, then and now, and the culture and politics of the time. You can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, fast forward some years. How do conflicts over creative control show up between Madonna and pop star Lady Gaga in recent years?
Yeah, there was actually a real big controversy a few years ago where Lady Gaga seemed to be borrowing from Madonna in the same way that Madonna had borrowed from others before her. But it was really presented as this kind of intergenerational conflict. Like Lady Gaga is the new Madonna in the 21st century. And Madonna obviously wasn't gonna have that. And so she pushed back and made fun of Lady Gaga at one of her performances, but it kind of, you know, set up this bit of a rivalry between them. And I think that because both artists had such loyal fan bases in the queer community in particular, where, you know, Lady Gaga's song Born This Way, for instance, became a kind of anthem for a lot of the gay civil rights movement. There was a lot of friends I know who had to like take sides in that battle. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think I'm one of these people that like, you know, wants us all to get along and hold hands. And I think that there's much to admire in both of their musical careers.
Ah, hold hands, something how you describe erotica.
Absolutely. You know, it's something that we all want, right? Especially, I think, in the isolation that we've experienced during the pandemic. That was one of the reasons why I was drawn back to erotica in its reference to a different pandemic, is that I think just some of the feelings of being disconnected, of not being able to be with our friends, even after the height of COVID-19, there's still like, I think a kind of latent social distancing that we never quite have recovered from. And that's something that Madonna's speaking to preemptively a bit in this album.
This is Assistant Professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College, Michael Dango's new book. It's called Madonna's Erotica, as we explore this 1992 album and the themes that resonate now. Where were you? Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Rewind to 1992. Madonna drops her fifth album, Erotica, and the entertainer and music industry powerhouse holds space for AIDS activism in her music, as we've been talking about. Beloit College Assistant Professor Michael Dango's new book, it's called Madonna's Erotica, offers cultural context then and now. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts to bring up 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We were just sampling a little bit of Fever there. What can you tell us about that song?
Yeah, it's such an interesting choice for this album. So, you know, covering maybe not even quite as well as Peggy Lee did in 1958. I mean, it was originally a song by R&B artist Little Willie John. I think what's so fascinating about Fever is that it takes on a kind of darker meaning in the context of HIV/AIDS, where the lines, you know, you give me fever, start to sound more like a symptom of a sexually transmitted disease. And so I think it's a curious choice for this album. It also just marks, though, I think Madonna's larger interest in thinking back. This is, you know, a very nostalgic song, a previous musical era. It comes through too in some of the kind of smoky lounge vibes with the snap fingers and things like that. So she's still maybe nostalgic also for a period before HIV/AIDS, where fever wasn't such a triggering word.
You think that the legacy of her music is mostly what we do with it. And I'm wondering, what should we do with it now?
That's a good question. I think that it's interesting what we make a Madonna a soundtrack for. And this is something that I've noticed ever since writing this book, you know, wherever I go, it's hard to actually go more than a day or so without Madonna playing in the background somewhere, you know, on the radio at the mall. You know,
I've had an earworm all week because of you.
Absolutely. And so it's kind of actually become a bit of a soundtrack just for day-to-day consumerism, for lack of a better word. It's because she's somebody that kind of everybody knows a bit, is kind of ubiquitous, which also speaks interestingly to how maybe she's become less controversial over the years, that she's maybe a safer choice these days compared to some other artists. But what I think, you know, remains most important is using her music as a way to honor and acknowledge the communities that she's borrowing from. So to go back to Vogue and some of the queer communities of color that have been really important for innovating music. That's important. We had a kind of revisit of this conversation last year when Beyoncé's Renaissance album came out, and it's borrowing a lot of the same materials that Madonna's drawing from in the early 90s, to the point that she collaborated with Madonna on what was called the Queen's Remix of her title track. And so that was a real moment where there was actually more mainstream attention called to the important original creators of Voguing, for instance. And that's what seems most important to do with some of this music, is to allow it to be a way to honor the past, as well as sustaining queer communities into the present.
As I was navigating through the book and listening to the music, but really watching these music videos in a whole new way, and seeing your insights there. And I just, particularly in the song Rain and the music video showing the Japanese technology and people working to make Madonna good, I'm just wondering, what were some of your takeaways from what were the messages, the visual messages of songs like Rain?
Yeah, it's such an interesting moment in how Asia and Asian aesthetics are being received in the West at this time as a kind of sign of two almost kind of contradictory things. On the one hand, like really sleek technology and robotics, the future. And on the other hand, minimalism, a kind of, you know, Zen aesthetic, or Marie Kondo's, you know, more recently Spark Joy kind of movement that's become associated with Japanese culture. And she is drawing upon those aesthetics in a music video like Rain to similarly position herself as being both of the future and also in a way kind of the past. But it's complicated because of how the Japanese actors in that video, for instance, end up being there to literally make her look good. They're kind of cast there to like shine the lights on her and to be adjusting the visuals. So she's, again, having a moment where she's drawing from a particular culture, but perhaps not paying it back in the same way.
We're taking a dive into Madonna's works from early 1990s. Michael Dango, author and assistant professor at Beloit College, our guide. Still time to talk? Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. As you mentioned, it's hard to go without, you know, a day hearing Madonna as part of some type of soundscape. Has Madonna influenced the direction of your scholarly research and where it goes from here?
It has, I think, particularly in my teaching. So I teach American culture a lot and kind of surveys of thinking about American culture and politics from the last 100 years. And as I've taught those surveys, I've been struck by how, first of all, important Madonna has actually been for, again, this moment in the early 90s as crystallizing controversies around censorship and culture wars related to that. At the same time, you know, one of the interesting things about being a professor is that I get a year older every year, but my students stay the same. And I think that for this generation, you know, Madonna is not as much of a touchstone, or you know, she's this old lady. She did indeed turn 65 this year, and it's been important for me to help my students understand the importance of figures that might even seem outdated to them today because of the legacy they've had. I mean, we wouldn't have people like, frankly, you know, Ariana Grande or Katy Perry or Lady Gaga, we talked about earlier, without some of Madonna's work paving the way to show that you could be a female entertainer and bring in the big bucks. So I think that that's something that continues to be relevant for me, is thinking about the kind of intergenerational scholarship we can do and how much we can continue to learn today from what might seem an older moment in pop culture.
Let's bring in Mike and Madison quickly. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, what was or what is her sexuality exactly?
That's complicated. Yeah, I think that especially in the early 90s, she really projected a kind of image of pansexuality. But she pretty much exclusively dated men. And in fact, biographers of her who have interviewed some of the bisexual or lesbian women in her orbit, those interview subjects tend to talk about feeling a bit used or led on even by Madonna at this time, of maybe being called in to make her look interesting or scandalous by having a non-normative sexuality, but not really in the end being interested in those relationships. So I think that her record indicates that she's frankly pretty straight, but has nonetheless been really important for the queer community.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been lovely having this conversation and listening to some Madonna together.
Michael Dango, author of Madonna's Erotica and an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.